Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney will be in studio in just a bit. He is asking voters to elect him to a second term, so we'll talk to him about a possible agenda for the next 4 years, as well as difficult to resolve issues like the high rate of homicides, the opioid crisis, backlash against the soda tax, and more. Also, there's new acclaim for Philadelphia's celebrated restaurant scene. Zahav has been named Best Restaurant in America by the James Beard Foundation. We'll catch up to Chef Michael Solomonov and business partner Steve Cook. But to start us off, the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant will shut down by the end of September. TMI became notorious 40 years ago as the site of a partial meltdown, and Radio Times recently took an in-depth look back at the disaster. Plans to decommission the aging reactor have been in the works, but there was hope by the parent company, Exelon, that a state bailout would come in time to keep TMI going. Now, it seems this isn't going to happen. PennLive's Charles Thompson has been reporting on the story, and he joins us now. Hi, Charles.
Hello. How are you?
Well, thank you. So a bit of backstory first. With climate change in mind, more states are considering increasing their reliance on carbon-free energy, and nuclear power seems to be enjoying a bit of a renaissance. Why was Exelon thinking about retiring Three Mile Island?
Well, in Harrisburg here, Three Mile Island has been losing money for several years. Basically, what we have in Pennsylvania is this boom of natural gas development with the exploitation of the Marcellus Shale reserves, with the advent of fracking technologies and so forth. And that natural gas has flooded the market. It's caused a lot of energy companies to convert coal plants to natural gas plants, build new natural gas plants. The price is lower, and it's made the nuclear energy plants just that much less competitive in terms of putting their electrons out there on the market, so to speak. TMI was the most susceptible to this kind of energy revolution caused by the natural gas explosion, because it is a single reactor nuclear power station. So essentially, they just don't produce enough juice for the cost to make it profitable. All the other nuclear stations in Pennsylvania are two reactors, so they're a little more cost efficient in terms of their operations and so forth. And so this kind of forced the hand on this debate about should nuclear be subsidized in Pennsylvania, and the clock ran out on Three Mile Island.
So there is legislation, or there was legislation before the State House and Senate that could have proven a game changer, and this didn't come in time. Exelon had a deadline. What was that deadline? What was that about? It was a June 1st deadline.
Yeah, it's basically a timing function here, though. We have five nuclear power stations in Pennsylvania. Four of them are running profitably right now. TMI has not for the past several years, as I've said. And TMI was due for a refueling later this year. And, it's refueling a nuclear station is not like driving up to the local gas station. I mean, it's an ordeal. The fuel assemblies have to be ordered and fabricated, and the plant has to be taken offline and while these fuel assemblies are switched out. And basically, in order to do this work this fall, Exelon had to place the order for their fuel by about this time, May, June of this year. So that was sort of the timeline they were operating under to try to get a subsidy that would be in time to help TMI.
And so the legislative bailout did not happen.
Yeah,
so
right.
Let's talk about the next steps. Decommissioning a nuclear power plant is an ordeal as well. It can take decades.
Yes. It's going to be interesting because if you drive by, as many locals in the Harrisburg area do, if you drive by that plant for the next 50 years, you're not going to really see that much different there. The cooling towers are going to stand. There won't be any steam or water vapor coming out of them anymore for sure. But the plant is basically going to be, it's essentially going to be mothballed for 50 years. The nuclear waste that's on the island will be staying there in a dry cask state. I mean, first, there's going to be a five-year period where it's in the spent fuel pools, which is essentially a large pool that the nuclear waste is housed in while it cools. And once it gets down to a certain temperature, they take it out and they kind of store it in what are essentially concrete bunkers. And it will stay there for about 50 years. The plan is that by that time, America writ large will have permanent nuclear waste sites, and that stuff will be offloaded off the island, and they will, crews will literally come down and sort of deconstruct the rest of the plant. And sometime about 2075, they're saying that 3 Mile Island might be released for its next use.
What might the next use be for something like TMI?
Well, the decommissioning plan that's in play right now would essentially, the goal of that is to kind of restore it to pre-nuclear plant conditions. So if all goes well, theoretically it could be another power plant. It could be some other industrial use. Perhaps it could be just some kind of a passive park. I mean, hard as that may be to believe, but.
Charles, TMI is located in, I think it's Londonderry Township, Dauphin County. Of course, yeah. A place forever made infamous because of the 1979 accident. Have you been able to get a sense of what the sentiment locally is about the decommission?
Well, sure. Hyper-locally, as in in the Lower Dauphin School District and in Dauphin County and in that township, there's a lot of concern about the loss of 650 jobs. I mean, good jobs. So this is sort of what any community would go through if they were facing the loss of a large employer. So there's that, the economic concern. Loss of some property tax base. So there's that on the very local scene. If you go out a couple more concentric rings and you talk about the Harrisburg area, this was a very complex issue because this was probably a bad neighborhood to start the let's subsidize nuclear power argument in Pennsylvania because, people in the Harrisburg area have kind of if you say TMI, it's not a happy memory because of a 1979 accident, right? Yeah. And it would have been preposterous to say 40 years ago, well, let's marshal, taxpayer ratepayer resources and help these nuclear power plants because we're going to need them in the long run for the fight on climate change. Tough uphill fight here because of, the memories of the accident.
Well, and also, as you mentioned earlier, the natural gas industry. We were recently talking on the roundup about a $300 million bailout for PSE&G plants in New Jersey. But do you see that happening to shore up the nuclear power industry in Pennsylvania, even as the state attempts to move toward cleaner sources, carbon-free sources of energy?
Yeah, I think this whole debate is going to hit a reset here in Pennsylvania now. And these subsidies have happened in New Jersey and New York and Illinois and Connecticut. Pennsylvania is still pretty reliant on nuclear energy.
How reliant?
I believe it is responsible for about 40% of the electricity that's generated right now. TMI coming offline only knocks out about 8% of that nuclear energy share. So don't kid yourself. Nuclear energy is still going to be 36-37% of our total energy load. And the thing about it is that as worried as people are about the the ramifications of the long-term ramifications of the nuclear waste. The actual production of the power is clean from an air pollution standpoint, and you can't really take away all that nuclear power and win the fight to reduce greenhouse gases, because in Pennsylvania it will be replaced with more natural gas plants in the short term, and that would bend the curve of declining emissions as we replaced coal with gas. You know, that's a net gain for us, but when we start replacing nuclear with gas, now we're starting to, you know, lose that fight again in the battle to reduce emissions.
What are you hearing? What is your sense of the concern about the radioactive aspect of nuclear waste? You know, it's been 40 years since the partial meltdown of TMI, that this might happen again. Is there a sense that this won't happen again, and therefore that is, it's a valid industry that does need to remain in place?
Yeah, I mean, I think in part because of TMI and Chernobyl and Fukushima and Japan, I think people in that industry believe, and I think many independent experts do too, that it's safer than it was a generation or two ago. And, you know, quite honestly, I mean, the safety record in America has been pretty strong since 1979 for commercial nuclear power. The waste is a lingering issue, but even there, I mean, I think there are plenty of scientists who feel like it can be stored safely. It's just a matter of, you know, finding the political will to sort of say, hey, you know, Yucca Mountain, you're it.
And that's that debate's been going on at least in 30 years, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, one activist calls nuclear
wants to be that site.
Yeah, no, but of course not for the waste, radioactive waste for the entire country. One activist calls the nuclear industry waste the biggest NIMBY on the planet, and that site in Nevada, again, that was the one that's been looked at, you know, by the federal government. So your sense is there is no movement forward on that, even as nuclear power as an alternative, a carbon-free alternative, is getting a real second look.
Well, yeah. In terms of you're asking about in terms of the subsidy bill in Pennsylvania now?
No, I'm asking in terms of a permanent repository.
Okay. Well, you know, I just think that's a national issue that, yeah, of course, people are going to have to come to grips with. And I really don't have a good read on where that stands, but I have to think that it's going to be done at some point because, you know, you can't
kick the can down the road forever.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right, Charles Thompson, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Charles Thompson is a reporter covering Pennsylvania government and public policy for the Patriot News and Penn Live. Up next in studio, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney. He is running for a second term. Primary day is May 21st. We'll talk to him in just a bit. Stay with us. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome back. As promised, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney joins us now. He is campaigning for a second term in office. Primary day coming up fast, May 21st. Lines are open if you'd like to call in for this short segment, 888-477-9499. You can also send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So welcome back, Mayor Kenney.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. Perhaps, assuming you're like the rest of us, mourning that heartbreaking Sixers loss last night.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's they're a good team, and they're going to get better, and just very disappointing.
Yeah, but, well, yeah, evenly matched teams. We just don't have Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah, I mean, ball bounced four times before it went in, so, you know, it was supposed to be, I guess.
It's one of those things.
Yep.
All right, so you're going for round two as Philadelphia mayor. Tell us about unfinished business.
Continuing to improve our education system, that really is important. We've made three consecutive years of increases in test scores and graduation rates. We're investing an unprecedented amount of money in our schools, $1.2 billion we're asking for over the next 5 years. It's twice as much money as they've ever gotten before because we stopped waiting around for Harrisburg to save us or Washington to save us. And these are our children, and we have responsibility to educate them to the point where they can meet their potential. And that will drive down poverty, it will drive down addiction, it will drive down crime, and our kids deserve it.
Crime is one of the biggest concerns expressed by Philadelphia residents in a recent Inquirer poll. Overall, during your administration, down 11%.
Right.
I don't have to tell you, though, that the homicide rate is up.
Homicide rate is up. Yep. If you look over the last 20 years, it does go up and down. I mean, and we wind up trying to judge this whole situation based on numbers. I mean, one homicide is one homicide too many. Mm-hmm. But you know, the number has been 300, and I think it's wrong that we should be acceptable for anything under 300. The problem is that guns consume this nation and consume the state, and legislatures not willing to control it, not even willing to allow us to control our own destiny. We have bills that the city council has passed over the years that the Commonwealth has preempted us. Reporting your gun stolen, which seems to be a pretty rational, reasonable approach, creates a straw purchase situation that allows people to purchase guns, turn them over to a criminal, have that criminal do something bad with the gun, and the gun gets traced back to you, and you didn't have to report you. You said, my house got burglarized, and somebody broke into my car, and they take their gun, but they don't have to report it. So it's the legislature has really been falling down on this issue. And, I mean, the other day we had five young men shot on the street by apparently three 15-year-olds with 9mm semi-automatic weapons. So how did they even get them?
So there are issues. Obviously, guns are a huge piece of it, but there are other issues, too, that contribute to the problem. And many would say, for instance, that poverty contributes to the high rate
poverty.
Of homicides.
Yep.
You know, why is Philadelphia still the poorest of America's big cities with a poverty rate of 26%? How do you even begin to attack that?
You attack it through education. You attack it through job training, workforce development. You attack it by reducing the number of people incarcerated in your prison system, and getting them trained and getting them a job is the major reason why poverty will go down is when everybody's working. And our people have not been prepared for the jobs of this century or for the next 10, 20, 30 years. And we need, as we're doing, investing in education to make sure that people are prepared to take those jobs.
Have you been able to move the needle much on that since you first took office? And what have been the challenges in moving that needle?
Well, the challenges are institutional racism that's going on in this country for the past 400 years. I mean, I've been in office 3+ years. I can't fix that, out of the box. And we're working towards more equitable society, a more equitable city, a more educated city. We've increased the number of people living here. We've increased the number of millennials who have come to the city. The city is growing, but some people are being left behind, and it's our job to bring those people forward.
Let's talk about stop and frisk.
Yep.
4 years ago, you campaigned to end the police department's practice of stop and frisk. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is your position has since evolved to keep stop and frisk in place, but not to target people of color.
Well, Terry v. Ohio is the law of the land from the Supreme Court ruling saying that with reasonable suspicion, an officer can stop someone and question them. We're down 260,000 pedestrian stops from 2015, beginning 2016, and we're down 90% in our unconstitutional stops. Having an officer stop someone is never going to stop. It's never going to end. And my opponents who are saying they're going to stop it on day one, first of all, my hope is they don't get there for day one. And secondly, they're not going to be able to do it. But 260,000 less stops, more discipline for police who violate our policy, and more training and more reporting keeps us transparent. We're in federal court with the ACLU before I even became mayor. We were in a court case, and every quarter, we go in and present our numbers, and the judge is happy, and NAACP is happy, but not fully happy. But yeah, they would like us to go faster, but 260,000 less stops in 3 years is pretty substantial.
Well, speaking of one of your opponents, State Senator Anthony Williams, he has been endorsed by the Black Clergy of Philadelphia and vicinity. Pastor Jay Broadnax told WHYY's Dave Davies that in part it was because your administration hasn't effectively curbed stop and frisk. So there's a perception there that is still hanging there that perhaps people of color are being targeted.
Well, I mean, people of color are being stopped more than none, and that's a problem when we're continuing to pursue the solving of that problem. I don't, the Black Clergy of Philadelphia and vicinity did not endorse me in 2015, and they again did not endorse me now, and that's, they certainly, I respect their right to support whoever they want to support, but I do have substantial members of the clergy in the city of Philadelphia are supporting me, and we'll see what happens election day.
Broadnax also says your administration has a poor record on diversity in city contracts and in high-level appointments. Your response?
Well, our diversity spend as a city is higher than New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, so I don't really know what he's speaking about. There was a controversial contract that was not awarded because we had pay-to-play laws because of the street administration's insistence on having politically connected contracts done, and we got away from that. I'm sorry that particular firm did not get the contract, but they violated the reporting requirements of the pay-to-play and were disqualified, along with a majority company that was disqualified.
Got some calls and comments coming in. We've got a comment from Farrah Dune who asks, what is the mayor going to do to help the taxi industry? We're suffering from terrible roads and unfair competition from Uber and Lyft.
Well, the road issue we're trying to catch up with. The last administration and other administrations basically almost stopped paving streets for the last few number of years of their administration. So they were down to 25 miles a year. The industry standard for smooth streets is about 131 miles. We're at 98 now, and we're continuing to increase our paving. We put on an additional paving crew of 30 people. We have three crews now with 90 people total, and we're catching up. It's a matter of we've appropriated $200 million to pave our streets. But as far as, the Uber and Lyft competition with taxis is something that's just basically the economy. It's how you compete. Yeah. Part of the problem with taxis has been what was, and not as much now because Uber and Lyft is now competitive with them. Drivers wouldn't take credit cards. They'd smoke in the car. They would eat in the car. It was not a pleasant experience getting a cab, 8-10 years ago. I think things have gotten better because they have more competition now with Uber and Lyft. So we'll see how it plays out. I don't want to interrupt. I don't know what I could do to interrupt that situation as far as making it more competitive for taxis.
All right, you're set to participate in a debate this evening hosted by NBC 10 and Telemundo 62. In the last week or so, some significant forums have come and gone. Your challenges were there. You weren't. How do you speak to the optics of the empty chair? Does that hurt your campaign?
I'm the mayor. I mean, the last time I ran in 2015, I didn't have a job. And all I could do was campaign. I have responsibilities during the day and responsibilities at night being mayor. I'm not going to cancel those appointments or those responsibilities in order to make my opponents happy. And they should run their own campaigns and not depend on me to bring attention to their campaigns.
But still, I think one was the Philadelphia Education Fund. I mean, there are important opportunities perhaps to discuss significant issues in the city.
When I have something scheduled as mayor, I'm not going to cancel something that's scheduled after that. And apparently there was a conflict between something we had originally scheduled and when they decided to do their forum, but I'm not going to disappoint the people we scheduled to be with in order to make the forum people happy or to make my opponents happy. So, it's just part and parcel of doing a job.
All right. One of the big issues is the fate of your signature achievement as mayor, and that is the enactment of a soda tax to fund the expansion of pre-K and also to help rebuild libraries, parks, and et cetera, in Philadelphia. The tax has been under attack from the get-go. The soda and other industries are still fighting hard to get rid of it. As I understand it now, the fight has now will probably go to city council. Right. If post-election, a newly shaped council does vote to get rid of this tax, what is your response?
My response will be a veto, and they don't have 12 votes to override it. You know, the beverage industry is extremely wealthy. I mean, Pepsi-Cola just posted their first quarter earnings, net earnings of $6 billion. So they have a lot of money to spend to twist people's minds against this thing. The bottom line is that you don't really need soda to live. As a matter of fact, drinking less soda will probably make you healthier. And we felt that this was a revenue stream that was dependable and that people can make a decision to buy the product or not buy the product. I've had some grocery store owners who were, you know, putting signs on their shelves telling people that the product is too expensive, and then they're surprised that people aren't buying it.
But what about a loss of jobs? I mean, there were losses in delivery and groceries, et cetera.
No.
I mean, is there any way to tweak tax?
We've looked at every segment of the retail grocery industry. Unemployment claims are down. Wage tax collections up, business tax collections up. We have stores, chains like Giant and others who are opening stores across the city. One of our biggest opponents to the tax opened two ShopRites since we passed the tax, and he's the one who puts signs on all his shelves telling people not to buy his product and then complains that they don't. We have Lidl from Germany that wants to come in here and build a couple of $2 or $3 million store in South Philly. Jeff Brown, who's the ShopRite owner who closed the store at Haverford Avenue, claiming that the soda tax killed his store. We have a new tenant in there now, or signed the lease to go in there, Key Foods from New York. He lost his lease. That's why he closed the store. It had nothing to do with the soda tax. The owner of the building sold the building to a New York real estate developer, and he didn't want to renegotiate his lease, so he closed.
Should you be reelected, the soda tax will likely stay in place.
It will stay in place.
Okay. Let's get to the phones. Mark in South Philadelphia joins us now. Welcome to Radio Times, Mark.
Good morning. Good morning, Mayor Kenney. I have a question for you. Just a few short weeks ago, my 15-year-old daughter and two of her teenage friends were at 12th and Locust praying in front of the Planned Parenthood clinic there. And I'm sure you've seen the videos of State Representative Brian Sims filming them and asking for a bounty to identify them. And I'm just curious, as I have not heard a statement from you about Representative Sims' behavior, I'm just curious where you stood on that occurrence and what happened.
Thanks for the call.
I know Brian Sims. I like Brian Sims, and Brian Sims was wrong. Doing what he did, it was uncalled for and not appropriate. But I do think that women should control their own bodies and should be able to make decisions on their own reproductive health without interference. So Brian did the wrong thing. He posted it himself, which brought all this attention to him. And I hope he's learned that lesson. But I do believe that trying to inhibit women's opportunities for health care and reproductive health is wrong also.
Comment from Miguel. How is the mayor going to help communities like my Latino community to invest in their neighborhoods in a way that can prevent them from being displaced by development and gentrification?
Well, there's a number of programs that have been put in place by council and the mayor's office relative to trying to fight back the gentrification issue. The long-term owner occupant program, which is basically a tax abatement for long-term owners who are living in gentrifying areas. The senior citizens tax freeze. We're investing $80 million at least, and maybe more, in supporting affordable housing and supporting housing people who have issues with the main systems in their home, their roof, their heater, their hot water heater, those kinds of things, kind of to stabilize people's homes. We're happy that people are moving into the city and that the city's hot and affordable. We'll try to protect the long-term residents best we can.
10-year tax abatement program has, you know, led to a building boom, but some are complaining about gentrification and the fact that it is hard for long-term residents to afford to stay there. Has its time passed? Is it time to tweak it, change it as we move forward?
I mean, I think it worked. I mean, obviously it's worked
past tense.
Commercially and residentially. The amount of development we have in the city is probably tied directly to that. Council is working on a couple different options that they can tweak it, limit it, reduce the length of time, cap the value of the houses that are abated. And I'm willing to listen to any of those recommendations.
What do you like?
I think it's fine the way it is. But if they want to reduce the term from 10 to 8 to 7, or they want to cap properties, eliminating abatements for properties over 500,000, those are reasonable things that we can do. But I think throwing it all out together is a mistake.
Philadelphia's opioid crisis, you support opening a supervised injection site. Let's go to Kensington, ground zero of the opioid crisis in the city. It's had the reputation of being the largest open-air drug market on the East Coast.
Right.
Is this still the case? And if so, how do you put a dent in the supply feeding the crisis in the first place? What does the police department need to do?
The crisis was created by greedy pharmaceutical companies and greedy doctors who over-prescribed opioids. And I had gallbladder removed a couple years ago, and I walked out of the hospital. They gave me 30 oxycodones. I'm like, what am I doing with that? I mean, so we work with our hospitals, work with our medical community to reduce the amount of prescriptions. I think our main responsibility is to keep people from dying. We had 1,217 people die last year, 1,100 the year before, and 900 the year before that. And if we don't look at every option, we're foolish. We, in order for people to survive and to get drug treatment and to get better, we have to have them in our vicinity. If someone shoots up alone in an alleyway and dies of an overdose, we can't help that person.
So you're referencing a possible supervised injection site, but how do you attack that open air market?
I call it the overdose reduction site more than that. And in Europe and in Canada, where they exist, no one's died in those facilities. The needles don't go on the street. They stay there. People do not overdose on the street. They do it there and are brought back. And we got to continue. I mean, what I really would like would be the federal government to pay as much attention to heroin sales as they do to immigration. These undocumented immigrants are not causing this problem, and they're putting more emphasis on building a wall and funding, ICE and others. If they put the ICE people on the drug people, maybe we could make a dent in it. Our police do the best that they can do with the resources that we have, but the federal government's not really helping us.
So in order to resolve this issue in Kensington, the federal government needs to step in to help stem the flow of heroin fentanyl into the country.
More than they're doing now, yes.
Okay.
I mean, do you really believe that the building the wall and funding border security is more important than people dying of overdose deaths?
Yeah. I'm not sure that people in Kensington, and we only have a couple seconds left, they're concerned about what's happening day to day outside their homes, on the sidewalks, their children going to school.
And a supervised injection site would stem that. You wouldn't see people injecting on the street. They would be inside somewhere.
Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney, okay.
thank you so much
for joining us.
All right.
Up next on Radio Times, Chef Michael Solomonov and Steve Cook of Zahav. Zahav won the James Beard Award for Best Restaurant in the country. We're going to hear about the restaurant and their plans and about how it feels to win that award. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The crown jewel of Philadelphia's restaurant scene is Zahav, which last week was named Best Restaurant in the Country when it won the prestigious James Beard Award. For frame of reference, the James Beard competition has been referred to as the Oscars of the food world. This was Zahav's first time as a nominee, and it was the first time a Philadelphia restaurant won the James Beard Award. For the rest of the hour, we'll be speaking with the two men at the helm of Zahav, Chef Michael Solomonov and business partner Steve Cook. And great to have you back with us here on Radio Times.
Thanks for having us.
So it's been a few days now since you learned the news that Zahav won. Have you come down from what I'm guessing was an out-of-body experience?
It was pretty surreal, but I think as soon as we landed back here in Philadelphia and had to get back to work, we were sort of already down on the ground.
Michael Solomonov?
Yeah, it was, we were feeling really excited and exhilarated, and we got off the airplane, and one of my cooks cut herself and had to go to the hospital, and then I had to come in and fill in. So in a very short period of time, we were brought back to the reality of what it is that we do.
I guess. Well, what went through your minds first when you heard that Zahav had won? Remember the thought that went through your mind?
I just remember, shouting. I don't know. Steve, how did you feel?
It was really humbling. I mean, to be in that room with the best of the best in our industry, and then to think about the roots, where Zahav came from and where it started out 11 years ago. It's been a incredible arc, and we've experienced very low lows, and to win that award was pretty awesome.
So for those who've never been, Zahav features Israeli cuisine. If you would choose one of your favorite meals and describe for us not the recipe for the dish or how it's prepared, but what goes into the process to produce a dining experience that makes it worthy of the James Beard Award.
So if you were to come into the restaurant with like three friends, you would sit down and you would be greeted and offered a wine list that has got, I think we have the most extensive Israeli wine list, including wines from the West Bank and Palestine and the rest of the world. And then you would order either cocktails or non-alcoholic cocktails, and you would get salatim and hummus, which means that you would get a bowl of hummus made with tahina with a daily topping, or Turkish hummus, which is I do that sort of with air quotes. It's a type of hummus that's baked with butter. Actually, in central Turkey, the dairy quality is so high, and it gets super cold, so they actually bake it with butter, and it's pretty – it's like cheating. and then you'd get laffa, which is like an Iraqi-style pita that's baked to order. And if it's Tuesday or Wednesday through Saturday and I'm not traveling, it's usually made by me. And then you would also get a six different salads, eggplant that's been twice cooked, beets with tahina, matbucha, which is a Moroccan pepper kind of salad, tabbouleh, pickles, you know, and so the table would be littered with all these bright, acidic, vibrant things that really tell the story kind of Israel and all the different cultures. And then you and your three other dining companions would each choose two mezes, so you'd get eight more dishes that came out. And then you would choose either entrees that were cooked over charcoal, and that could be whole roasted eggplant, marinated mushrooms, ground beef, ground lamb, fish cooked like crispy skin over charcoal, or you'd get our lamb shoulder, which is brined, smoked, confit in chicken fat, and glazed with pomegranate molasses with a pot of Persian rice that's really crispy.
How many people are on the team to bring this experience to life?
Oh, man.
You thanked a lot of people.
75 people around?
Yeah, it's about 75 now. It's a lot. It takes a lot to pull that off.
Yeah. So the inspiration for this sort of cuisine, let's talk about the trip that you recently took to Israel. You wanted to explore Israeli cuisine and invited a prominent food critic to go with you, Craig Leban. That's something that would be considered rather extraordinary in your world to start with. First of all, what is your relationship with Craig like? I imagine everybody's blood pressure goes up a little bit when a food critic walks in the door. And you know he's there, and he knows you know he's there, but you ignore each other. That's the way the drill goes, right?
We pretend not to know that we know each other. And I think out of respect for what he does, and you know, there's a dance that you do with critics. You try to, you know, you try to put your best foot forward, and you try to be prepared for when they walk in. But the reality is, you're never going to be better than you are. And even if you could fool a critic, you can't fool, you know, 300 customers every single night. So it was another surreal experience to be traveling with the food critic of record in Philadelphia, and sort of had to compartmentalize it. But he's been writing about us for our entire careers and had actually never been to Israel. And so, you know, that's kind of the way, whether it's our staff or our guests, the sort of idea behind the whole restaurant is to bring people to Israel, whether in reality or on the plate. So to have the opportunity to travel with Craig in Israel and see the food through his eyes for the first time is really special. And it was great.
And noteworthy, he's not going to be reviewing your establishments for a while. He is taking a step back, so
we'll have to figure out.
There's no conflict of interest.
Is.
Yeah. So the trip to Israel was 36 tasting stops in a marathon of food. What were you seeking, Michael? 36 tasting stops.
I mean, I think that it's just, I'm not sure if there's any sort of like goal. What I want people to understand is the diversity in food. I want them to feel the sort of vibrancy of what it is and see the colors and smell the spices and really understand the people there. I think that's sort of the goal. And we do that through food. So it was 36 stops in 3 days and everybody had a good time. And we didn't really repeat that much. That's also the thing. I mean, there's just so many different kinds of meals, kinds of dishes, kinds of cultures that make up Israeli cuisine. So it was really It's that. I mean, I've been talking to Craig. I've been trying to bait him onto a trip to Israel for over a decade. And the fact that one day he decided that he would do it. I think he was at a wine tasting. He might have been a little bit buzzed and was like, yeah, I'm going to come. And then I was like, oh, no, Craig's coming with us to Israel. But we do that. I mean, I go to Israel a bunch to visit family and for vacation, but also, you know, for work. And I think we've sort of made it part of what we do, part of our ethos to bring people to Israel. As Steve was saying, it's we do that with Zahav, you know, and it's like a little bit cheaper than buying a plane ticket and going. But that's kind of ultimately what our mission is.
So let's talk a little bit more about this marathon of tasting. Craig LeBan writes, Michael, that you told him that the trip would give him meat sweats at night. And I mean, you're trying such an extraordinary amount of food in such a short time. How do you do that without becoming, well, sick of it, as good as the food is, and you, even physically, you know,
well,
sick of
right.
it, we're just tired of
I mean, I think there were probably points where we were a little bit sick of it. But, I mean, a few things. One, we all love to eat. This is kind of what we do. And I guess we didn't finish that many meals, even though we finished more than I thought we were going to. Also, we're running around. So it's like you don't really stop. And I think your metabolism probably gets accustomed to that. And also every bit of food that you eat there, you know, all the produce is grown within 100 miles of where you eat it. And so the idea of the locavore is that wasn't a catchphrase. That wasn't a trend. That wasn't like, you know, a diet or anything like that. That's just sort of by, you know, Israel is essentially an island when it comes to trade. So everything is from there, and I think that your body just reacts to it very differently. You're eating vegetables. You're eating raw vegetables essentially throughout the day. You're starting with chopped salad and house-made yogurts and those sorts of things. So you're not eating. It's a very different experience than like eating in the States, for example. If you were to have 36 meals in 3 days in the U.S., like what would that be? How would you react? How would you go to sleep at night or get up the next morning and go? So it's a little bit different there.
Well, Steve Cook, tell us of some of the flavors in the dishes you tried that were like nothing you've experienced and nothing you could find here in the United States that would help you to do what you do with Israeli cuisine.
Well, you know, we had been on an 82-stop tour last summer for our cookbook. And so and that was over 10 days, so it was a little bit of a slower pace. And we went back to some of these places and we brought some chefs with us for the first time who are going to help open new places for us. And I mean, I think one of the examples that I would come back to, which is something that people don't really know about, but in Israel, it's sort of becoming on every street corner, which is an Iraqi sandwich called sabir, which was brought over by Iraqi Jews in the 1950s. And it didn't become a sandwich until it came to Israel, because Israel is great at stuffing things in pitas and making sandwiches out of them. But the tradition comes from the Iraqi Sabbath stew, the overnight Sabbath stew, and they pluck these ingredients out of it, like eggplant and hard-boiled eggs that were cooked overnight and stuffed it into a pita with amba, which is this pickled mango condiment that comes from the Iraqis' history as traders in the Indian subcontinent. So there's a whole story of this people in a pita that you get on the street for $5. And it's, in addition to being delicious, it really tells the story of, you know, what Israeli cuisine is all about, not just sort of Middle Eastern food, but all these all these cultures that have gathered there over the last, you know, 100 years.
We are such quick eaters in America. How should we be eating in order to really experience food, Michael?
I am not a good spokesperson for the way that people should be eating. My meals are like in a car. My meals are cups of coffee going from one place to the other. I just don't, you know,
if you really want to sit down and enjoy a meal, I mean, I know that I probably would sit down at a restaurant because I eat so quickly and I would be tempted to do the same thing. But you don't want to do that, especially if you're really going to experience something like you are bringing to Zahav.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Zahav is not a particularly fancy restaurant. I think it is a special place, but I don't practice. I mean, I can't sit through a 3-hour meal, and I have 2 little kids. So my meals are like,
oh, there you go.
Me eating over the sink and, you know, bribing them with like dessert. So they eat what it is that they eat. But, you know, what I like about Israel is that, like the breakfast is like vegetables and salads and that sorts of, and that sort of thing. And I just feel like that, that's the thing that I miss the most when I get back to the States. You know, I don't, it just never translates. It never works. As much discipline as you try to have in the morning about like sitting down and having a proper breakfast, it never really pans out.
The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, did it hover in the background someplace on this trip, Steve Cook?
I think it's always there. I mean, weird.
Like how you gave Steve the really hard one. And Steve, how do we solve that?
We'll
have five
you.
More minutes. Let's go.
It's always there. You know, it's something we chose to open Zahav, an Israeli restaurant, to try to portray Israel in a different light than you see it on the TV news. But it's a problem that's there. It's a problem that we think about all the time. And but the people in Israel, they live their life, and so do we.
Yeah, Michael, you share a close professional relationship with the Palestinian who's author of The Palestinian Table, and I'm not sure how to pronounce the name. I don't want to get
Areem Kassis. Yeah, okay. I mean, we're not, I would say professional barely, but personal. Yeah, we're very good friends.
Yeah. So, I mean, how did that figure into this trip that you took to Israel to try the foods? You know, the foods were also of some of them of Palestinian origin as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that eating Palestinian food is something that you do by eating Israeli food. I think that there's always been the stigma, and I'm a pretty open person, and I respect and acknowledge Palestinians' right to independence. But I think that there's the stigma that I've been trying to figure out in my more recent years is that when you start acknowledging the other side, I would say the same thing probably or it's probably harder even for Palestinians to say Israeli, because it's just got such a weird tone. Because when you acknowledge the other side, somehow it means that you aren't like allowed this right to exist. So if we say Palestine, somehow that should mean like not Israel. And I feel like we need to get over that. I think that's just tired. I think it's divisive. And I think it's sort of like irrelevant at this point.
So I will toss you the hard question now, or harder, a shared love for really good food, you know, obviously is not going to resolve harsh and complicated political differences, but can time at the table, discovering commonality in cuisine, in history of cuisine, in flavors, in foods, in breakfasts even, can that lead to a softening and a dialogue, or is that just too simple?
No, I think that the human element is sort of lost when it comes to things like diplomacy or conflict resolution. And it's much easier, it's much more convenient to alienate and to hate and to be ignorant, essentially. And I think that and as cliched as it is, and we discuss this all the time, Steve says that, you know, what we do is about hospitality and inclusion, right? Which is sort of the inverse of what everybody else is doing. So I think that it has to work. And I think that when you meet people and when you invite them into your home or at your table and I hate the cliche of breaking bread, but it works a whole lot better than watching TV and making judgment or listening to perhaps leaders that it's not in their best interest to have peace and to resolve. So, yeah, I don't know. At the end of the day, I can't like we can't. I'm not going to tell somebody that I have a right to something that they don't have. And that's just not who we are as people.
Back to Zahav. Does anything change now since the James Beard Award at the restaurant? Steve?
Well, we had about 7,000 missed calls on the day after day after we won the award. I mean, I think our job got harder. There are already high expectations. People wait a long time to get a reservation at Zahav, and they come in expecting greatness. And this accolade that we got just bumps that up. And, you know, the thing is, you can't eat awards. The people that are coming into the restaurant tonight, if we don't deliver, then the award means nothing. So that's why I think Mike and I love what we do, because we're constantly trying to improve the restaurant every year for 11 years. That's our goal at the beginning of the year, is how do we make the experience a little bit better? And that's not going to change until we close the restaurant.
Michael, we've got about 15 seconds. Anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think it's really every year and it's every day. What makes the experience better for the guest today versus yesterday?
Yeah. Well, what a pleasure to have you both in studio again with us. Thank you so much. Michael Solomonov and Steve Cook of Zahav, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Remember, we love to hear from our listeners on social media, and we've got a whole library of podcasts for you to head to, or to listen to, I should say. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times. Thank you.